The U.S. Supreme Court has ruled that a man sentenced in a court of Indian offenses can also be prosecuted by a federal court for the same incident. The defendant, a member of the Navajo Nation, was charged and sentenced in connection with violent sexual offenses committed on the Ute Mountain Ute Reservation against another citizen of the Navajo Nation. The man was later charged and sentenced for the same incident in federal court, but he argued that was double jeopardy, being charged twice for the same crime. The Supreme Court rejected that argument. I spoke earlier about this case and its implications with Stacy Leeds, Foundation Professor of Law and Leadership at the Sandra Day O'Connor College of Law at ASU. She's also a tribal judge. And we started by talking about how it seems as though the defendant was concerned about the double jeopardy issue between the tribal court and the federal one.
Yeah, there's a nuanced piece, though, about this case, which is why it attracted the Supreme Court's attention. We have known for a very long time that there is something called the dual sovereigns doctrine. And it says that if someone is prosecuted by a tribal court, they could be subsequently prosecuted by the federal court as well. And then the same thing goes for the dynamics between the state and the federal government. You know, sometimes there's a crime in one sovereign that then is also a different crime in another sovereign. What was different about this case is that it wasn't your typical tribal court setting, but it was in a court that's administered by the federal government called the Courts of Indian Offenses. And it operates on a few Indian reservations still. And so it, you know, raises this question, was it a tribal court or was it a federal court enough in nature that this person was prosecuted by two different federal courts? And that, you know, perhaps would be a violation of double jeopardy. And so that's why this was such an interesting case.
Right. Well, and a majority of the justices decided that the first court, the Court of Indian Offenses, apparently was not enough of a federal court to preclude this gentleman from also being prosecuted in federal court, right?
Yeah, the Supreme Court held in this case that that second prosecution in the Colorado District Court did not violate principles of double jeopardy, but they really focused on what was the definition of the underlying crime that took place on the reservation and sort of sidestepped this question of, is that Court of Indian Offenses really federal enough in nature or not? And so what they focused on was that first prosecution, although it was in a Court of Indian Offenses, the charge and the definition of crime was borrowed from the local tribal code. So by definition, it was a tribal offense, as opposed to a federal definition of a crime and a federal offense.
So what exactly is the Court of Indian Offenses? How similar or different is it than a tribal court, a traditional tribal court, or, you know, what we would think of, you know, in the federal justice system?
Well, that was the other thing that made this case so complex. These Courts of Indian Offenses were created by the federal government in the late 1800s to impose outside rules on tribes and to use that as part of the criminalization of conduct on the reservation that was not offensive to that culture at the time. So these courts come from this terrible place of stamping out tribal culture and tribal law, but then they've evolved over time. And that's what made this case so difficult, is that although there aren't very many of these courts left across the country, they are an option for a tribe to choose instead of having their own court for resource or efficiency reasons or for a host of reasons. A tribe may choose to have one of these localized courts. So for people like myself who've practiced in these courts, they are very different than their historical counterpart, and they are the local court, you know, on that reservation. So they tend toward a tribal court experience, although there are still, you know, a lot more federal pieces to that than what you would see in a wholly tribal court.
How common or uncommon is it for a defendant to be charged and sentenced in tribal court and then be charged for the same circumstance, even though it might be a different definition, different actual crime, in federal court or even state court?
I don't know the specific statistic, but it's not uncommon that that could happen. And part of the issue is that there have been so many federal laws that restrict what a tribal court is able to do with their sentencing powers and, you know, other powers, that this dual system of tribal and federal is necessary for safety on the reservations. If a tribal court had full control over their sentencing and definition of their laws, there wouldn't be a need for the federal government to be involved in these cases. But where those restrictions on the sentencing powers of tribal courts, you know, come in, where these crimes are very serious, it oftentimes requires, you know, for public safety purposes, that subsequent federal prosecution. For a crime, no matter how serious it is, the largest sentence that a tribal court could impose is 3 years for a specific offense. So you could see the situation where, because of that federal constraint on tribal power, that it's very necessary to have the U.S. attorney and the federal courts involved in some of these cases.
Why do those restrictions exist? I mean, that seems like it would put some limits on a sovereign.
It definitely places limits. And, you know, they've been on the books for quite some time. And it was public policy at the time, in 1968, when the law was passed that I'm referring to. Congress seemed to be quite suspect of tribal powers.
Do you think that, based on the decision in this U.S. Supreme Court ruling, does anything change in the tribal justice system?
Not for most tribes, no. You know, as I said before, this concept of a dual sovereigns doctrine has been part of the law for decades. And so with the overwhelming majority of tribes across the country, this case is not directly applicable because they don't have a court of Indian offenses. For the ones that do, it answers a question that has probably been hanging out there for quite some time, about whether these subsequent prosecutions coming out of these types of courts are going to be treated in the same fashion as the other tribal courts.
All right. That is Stacy Leeds, Foundation Professor of Law and Leadership at ASU Sandra Day O'Connor College of Law. She is also a tribal judge. Stacy, thank you so much for your time. Thanks for your insights on this. I appreciate it.
Thank you for the invitation. It was good to be with you.